Hello, and welcome to today's Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And today's program, we have a number of guests, but this morning we're going to start out first with Rick Heffelbauer. He's the Washington County Extension Horticulture Agent, and there's some great ways to garden in southern Utah, and that's what our focus is for the first 10 or so minutes of the program. Rick, thanks so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Now, I do have to give you my condolences. I'm so sorry to hear about you losing your extension building down there.
Yeah, it's been quite an ordeal the last month or so with the office burning, but we're getting our way back to normal here slowly but surely.
So that people who need to use your services know how to contact you, why don't you, is it just a phone number or do you have a permanent location, well, at least for the next little while your new building is going up?
In about a week or so, we'll actually move to another building. They can still reach us at our phone number, which is 435-634-5706. They can still reach us on that line. But what we have to do is take messages and transfer and so forth. So they just have to be patient. You know, usually what we'll do is have someone pick up that line and take messages, and then we can call them back within a couple of days. We are still doing our Master Gardener class, and we're still, doing the usual gardening classes, pruning demonstrations. So the best way to get a hold of us on those kinds of things is just to go to the Dixie Gardener website. So it's just dixiegardener.org, and they can get up to speed on a lot of the activities, gardening activities that are going on through the website.
Well, let's launch right in. And here in northern Utah, I am going to plant peas if I can get that soil turned just as soon as I can, but I've got snow all over the place here in Cache Valley. In southern Utah, are you at that point where it might even be too late to plant some things, or is now a great time?
No, we are just coming into just our perfect early spring season. Temperatures here, you probably, if you watch the weather forecast, we've been in the 50s for a while. We're now creeping to the 60s, and they're calling for maybe 70 by the weekend. And so as that occurs, you know, the soil temperatures start to warm up a little. But, no, this is really a great time for planting peas, spinach, onions, radishes, all those real early vegetables, you know, that the frost won't bother too much. This is the time to do it.
How far would you say that you're ahead of northern Utah as far as the growing season?
We usually figure a good 30 days, maybe a little longer, but we just figure round numbers probably about a month or so ahead.
But even that changes just so close in elevation. You are going from St. George to Cedar City. So are you still a month ahead of Cedar City, or is that more like 3 weeks?
Cedar is going to be probably a lot more like it is in Salt Lake. Like, for example, we tell people here our last frost date is the 1st of April on the average. But for Cedar and surrounding areas, even some still into Washington County, like New Harmony, for example, we tell people to wait till at least May 1st, maybe even to the 15th. And so I'm not sure. That probably correlates pretty close to Salt Lake. I'm not sure what the frost date is there.
Okay. And so what questions do you get most often right now? Like I usually hear from people in southern Utah, they'll ask me, well, what can I do with my soil? Because the soil is quite a bit different. There's not as much, well, maybe it's a different kind of clay, but it seems to be more porous type of soil than what you would find up here.
Yeah, we have a little bit of everything down here. It really kind of depends on where they're located, and that is a common question that we get a lot. Matter of fact, people spend a lot of time and sometimes money trying to improve their soil. If you go over to kind of the western part, or just west of St. George, kind of west-north, you get into Ivins, Red Mountain area, and that is real sandy soil. The sand's come off of the Red Mountain there, and it's just as red as brick almost an orangey red color, and it's very light, sandy soil. And those soils really need a lot of organic matter. That's the primary thing that people need to do is beef up their soil with organics. And that will improve that water-holding capacity somewhat, too, because, as you mentioned, the sand, the moisture will tend to just run right through sand pretty quickly. Then as you get into other areas of the county, we have everything from a loam, you know, which is a nice mixture, and to where you get into places like Washington Fields and Little Valley, which is where a lot of our new housing developments are. And those soils are dominant, predominantly clay. And so the challenge with those is sometimes there's so much clay, they're sticky clays. And so people have a little difficulty working them, especially if it's at all moist. And again, organics is probably going to be the best thing they can do even in those soils. I would think, you know, straw, sawdust, even some coarse organic material to help break up that clay will help a lot in those kinds of soils. So those are the real common things people do ask, and this is a good time. Actually, fall would have been a good time to actually improve soils, but because then it sits over winter, you know, and has a chance to mellow and compost out a little bit if there's some salts in there and so forth. But now is probably the next best time.
Where's the best access for those types of materials? I mean, is there a landfill place like there is here in Logan where I could go and pick up those types of materials?
Yes, actually, there are a few places like that. Things have kind of changed around a little bit over the last year or so. Our landfill does carry compost, and up until about 6 or 8 months ago, they were mixing a sewage sludge with it, and I just was told recently that they stopped doing that. So I understand at least that the compost out there does not have sludge. So it's a yard waste type of compost that people could pick up there. I'm not sure what it's selling for. I think it's pretty reasonable. They were loading it, you know, by the scoop into pickup truck and that sort of thing for people. Also, on the way out to the landfill, there is another place called Western Rock, and they are also selling compost and topsoil. And I believe their main source of compost is coming from the fairgrounds where horses are kept for horse shows and races and that type of thing. So that's mostly a bedding, you know, a horse manure with straw bedding. So those would be great. I think both of those would be really good sources for people. And then there are a couple of nursery locations. Star Nursery now has several locations, and they sell a bulk compost and a bulk topsoil. So the thing I always tell people to kind of be aware of is, depending on where the compost is coming from that's being sold, it may be a bit high in salt. And so that's one thing that they'll want to check, you know, ask the place you're buying it, you know, what it's comprised of, and if they've had a test, what we call an EC or electrical conductivity test for salt. That's an easy test to run through Utah State University Soil Lab, and it's pretty reasonable. I think the entire test for nutrients and everything is only about $14, and so people can send that through, and then they know what they're dealing with before they apply it to their garden.
With the compost, where is the salt coming from? Is it? I know I'm really careful with my chickens, and when I'm cleaning out the coop, to make sure that it's going to be very well composted. I don't want to just throw it on when it's still quite fresh. But certain animals, of course, it seems to be a higher content than others.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It does come from the manures, and so that's the thing to watch. And so that's why usually if the compost is just yard waste, that we don't easily see too much salts in there. But as soon as you add animal manures to it, it will start to go up. And I think your poultry manures are going to be slightly higher probably than something like cow manure, and then horse manure would probably be maybe even a little bit less. But all of them can contain salt. And so the thing that you're sometimes not sure of course, when you buy the compost is how much is bedding and how much was manure. And so it's still, you know, a good thing to do. As you mentioned, you know, use it carefully. You know, and I think one thing that I run into with people sometimes is they'll look at their soil and think, wow, you know, I've got so much to do to improve the soil. So they'll just bring in a huge load and dump it on top of the garden. And that can get into trouble sometimes, too. What you really need to do is just put a couple inches on at a time and work that in really good. And it's better if it's done, you know, once or twice a year rather than just putting a whole bunch on and then waiting 3-4 years and then doing it again. You know, it's much better to put small amounts on and work it in. The other thing that we run into sometimes is if the salts are high, people can pile that compost and simply run a sprinkler on it for a little while. What that will do is it will leach the salts out. Of course, you wouldn't want to do it if you didn't have to, but I've had people test their compost and it's come back quite high. And after doing that, running that on there for a while, it will leach the salt through, and then they can go ahead and put the compost onto their garden without the salt. Of course, you want to pile it somewhere where you don't mind if the salt runs out of there and is possibly going to burn something. So it needs to be a little ways away.
So the pile of chicken manure that I've had sitting for about a year and a half should be pretty good.
Oh, yeah. That should be fine. So sitting outside for a year and a half, it should be ready in good shape to put on the garden now.
Well, you're listening to the Zesty Garden. Rick Heffelbauer is Washington County's Horticulture Extension Agent. And if you have a question or comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page your question or comment. And also, while you're there, make sure you vote on your favorite mug design for our next fundraising mug. And then you can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So with gardening in southern Utah, I'm always thinking of heat, but that's really only what months? June, July, and August? Usually concerned about the heat?
Yeah, you're exactly right. It starts to heat up in May, but May still is a good gardening month here. And as I mentioned, April 1st is the last frost date. So we usually tell people, get your tomatoes and peppers and things like that in right around the 1st of April and take advantage of the cool temperatures before that for your early spring garden. And then April and May is great for those things like, melons, squash, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant that require some heat. And then usually the latter part of May, you're going to notice temperatures are getting up there in the mid-90s. And so by June, first, second week of June, it's going to be 100 degrees, and it'll pretty much reach 100 or so June, July, and August, and then start to cool down about the middle of September. So the best thing people can do is, again, plant as early as they can and take advantage of the nicer temperatures. And then people seem to do one of two things. They either figure it's so hot in the dead of summer that they will kind of let the garden go and stop watering it and finish out about, middle of July when it really just kind of stays pretty hot every day. And then maybe replant a fall garden, which you can usually do in September. Sometimes things that they take a little while to mature, like sweet corn or green beans, people will plant probably around the 1st of August and keep it well watered. And so you get through that heat in August, and then by the time the beans and the corn are trying to pollinate and set, ears and so forth, usually it's cooling off about September 15th, 20th. It finally cools down, and then we have very pleasant fall temperatures right into the 1st of November before it usually freezes. So that's the thing to do, is kind of look at it as two seasons. And some people will keep their tomatoes alive through the summer, realizing they may not get much then during that August period, into July, August. But once it cools off, they will start to flower again if they're healthy plants. And a lot of times they'll bear again right into November and sometimes early December.
Do you have a favorite vegetable that you can grow in the St. George area in Washington County but doesn't get grown too often that you would recommend to people?
Well, gosh, probably my favorite vegetable to grow is tomatoes, just because we crave them through the winter and we like fresh tomatoes, in the spring and summer. I was just trying to think of something that's not grown too often down here that actually could be is sweet potatoes. That's something that that I enjoy, and I think a lot of people do. And actually, people will call sometimes and say, gosh, will those grow in St. George? And, the answer is yes, they will. They actually don't mind the heat as long as you have them in good composted soil and keep them well watered. And they really don't like the cold. So you do kind of wait till the last frost date. You can put in the little slips. They call the little plants that you put in slips. So they're a little different than a regular potato. an Irish potato. These will look more like a small plant. And then, like I say, keep them well watered. And they really kind of don't mind the heat so much as some things. But I would probably try to keep them out of full afternoon sun, maybe a shade cloth or, you know, a side of the house or something that doesn't get that really hot afternoon sun. And they should do really well. I've seen people down in the Washington and Washington Fields area bring me really nice sweet potatoes, so I know they grow well here.
So you just use a floating row cover on them?
You could do that early. You know, you could do that early. Sometimes the row cover, when it's close to the plant in the ground, will actually heat the soil up a little.
Okay.
You could probably do more of a shade cloth that's kind of permeable, let some air through it, you know, and that way it wouldn't heat up. But we're seeing more and more people use shade cloths down here. The word's gotten out in the nurseries and supply places like IFA and Steve Regan are carrying shade cloth in rolls, you know, and packaged already for people to use on their gardens. And we're seeing a lot of people do little hoops over their gardens with the small PVC pipe and then drape the shade cloth over that. Usually starting in about May, they'll put it on and keep it on right through the summer. And it really makes a difference, even with something like peppers that need a fair bit of heat. They seem to do better if we can get the direct sun off of them.
And then it doesn't sunburn the fruit.
Exactly, right. And sunburn some years is really bad. We lose about as much to sunburn on peppers and tomatoes as we do anything. So it is making a big difference.
And these are just black cloths that let a little bit of sun through?
Yeah, sometimes they're black. I've seen them green now. You'll see a lot of them are green, and they're come in so much percent shade. So what we usually recommend is at least about a 50% shade seems to work really well. So it really is cutting down the light, you know, the direct light in particular, and kind of makes a more softer shaded light onto the garden.
Well, we have a question from Steve in Beaver Dam, Arizona. He said that he's about 25 or 30 miles southwest of St. George in Santa Clara, and the soil here is every bit as sandy as you would imagine. I have a lot of ash from the wood stove and fireplaces, and I'm currently overseeding the grass on my lawn. Does wood ash make a suitable soil amendment or grass fertilizer for these conditions?
That's a good question. Wood ash is a good fertilizer, but again, I would use it sparingly. It is a source of potash. And so, and that's one of our major nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So I would say yes, but I would kind of use it like the manure. I would use it sparingly, and I would mix it with my soil. I wouldn't use the wood ash directly over top of grass seed or seeded vegetables. I would, again, mix it with some topsoil or peat moss or something that would kind of neutralize or mellow that wood ash out just a little bit.
So work it into the soil.
Exactly.
As a general. Okay.
Yep.
Great. Thanks for your comment, Steve. And just one last question that I have for you is, when do you look at putting in your warm weather crops, things like corn or even putting in melons?
Yeah, so usually what we do is we'll tell people here, these last 2 weeks of February, go ahead with your real early vegetables. And then once you get past 1st of March, you've got a period in there during the month of March where you could plant things kind of like what you mentioned. Corn, string beans would be fine, carrots. These are things that like the soil to be a little bit warmer. You could go ahead and seed those during the month of March. But then things that you're going to put a plant out, like a pepper plant or an eggplant or a tomato, wait a little longer till closer to the 1st of April. We do sometimes still get some freezing weather, and so April 1st is usually, you know, if you wait that long, generally you won't have the problem with it dropping below 32 on you. So that's kind of how I would stage it with the really early season things now, and then wait just a little bit, a couple more weeks, 3 weeks or so into March for corn, beans, things that need some warm soil, and then the really heat-loving things, which squash, pumpkins would kind of fall into that category. Melons really need the heat. I would probably push those off till just around the 1st of April.
And what is your next gardening class that you've got going?
Actually, I have one tonight. It's over at the main library location here in St. George, and it's at 6:30, and we're going to talk about some of these very topics that we've been discussing, how to prepare the garden and what you could be planting here in these next couple weeks for early season vegetables.
Is it a series or one evening class?
This is just a one-night class they've asked me to do. We did one also over at the Tunequint Nature Center last Saturday, and then there's another one on the 22nd of February, again at the Nature Center at 10 a.m. So these are just one-time classes for people to kind of get up to speed on how to vegetable garden here in St. George.
And do they need to register for this?
No, for this class this evening, they wouldn't. And I would say even for the ones over at the Nature Center, the only reason we register is just to get a head count. Last week we had probably 40 people and ended up having to turn a few away. And so I would say just go early. But they don't have to register for those.
And it begins at what time again tonight at the library?
Tonight's at 6:30 at the main Washington County Library downtown here in St. George. And then the 22nd of February, that's at 10 a.m. at the Tunequint Nature Center.
Okay. Rick, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you.
You've been listening to Rick Heffelbauer. He is Washington County's Extension Horticulture Agent. And we hope that you'll stay tuned for the rest of the program. Diane Alston will be coming up for the next half of the program, so stay tuned. Welcome back to the second part of The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Diane Alston. She is USU's Extension Entomologist, and we'd love to have your questions or comments, and our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can email us at zestygarden@gmail.com or go to the UPR Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Thanks for coming in, Diane. It's the beginning of a new growing season.
Yes, hope there's going to be some gardens ahead.
Well, I like the rain. I also love the snow, but I'm reaching that point in February where I'm going, okay, I'm ready to get out into the yard and get something done.
Well, and we are getting some much-needed moisture in the north here now, so yeah. Things are shaping up nicely.
So why are we talking insects at this time of the year?
Well, I don't know. You invited me in, Brian. Tell me.
But, so one of the things that prompted that was there's a from the Utah Plant Pest Diagnostics Laboratory and USU Extension, there's a publication entitled Utah Pest News. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask you about thrips, you know, because start talking about that. This one has a question and a section about onions and how thrips are devastating the farmers. So we have farmers that listen to this program. So why don't you talk about onion thrips?
Well, and there's many kinds of thrips. So onion thrips are just one type. The two most common that we have in Utah are the western flower thrips and onion thrips. And both of them have very broad host ranges. So even though onion thrips has onion in the name, it doesn't only attack onion. It attacks many ornamentals, flowering plants, most of the vegetables in your garden, you know, grasses, broadleaf plants. So that said, that's partly why they're such important insects, despite their little tiny size. But they can feed on a wide range of different kinds of plants. They reproduce rapidly at least for some of the species, they are reproduce asexually, and so it's just mothers producing daughters, and so it's they can develop resistance to insecticides more rapidly because of that behavior and high generation overturn. So lots of thrips building up quickly, and those are the characteristics that make them such tenacious pests. In addition to one other big thing, which is a number of them vector diseases, in particular viruses. And so the tomato spotted wilt virus, which we've had an increasing problem with in Utah in the last couple years, and then in the onion crop, they're dealing with a virus called iris yellow spot virus. And so there are two different ones that are causing quite a bit of widespread concern.
Okay, so I grow a lot of iris. Mm-hmm. Is this something I should be concerned about?
Well, the iris is susceptible to it as well. The symptoms on onion make these lesions on the leaves, and the iris also gets some damage on the leaves, but it's not quite the same pattern as you might see on onion. but it certainly harms the overall plant health. And so what it does in onion is it makes the bulb size smaller, and so you don't get as big of an onion. And so it's doing that to iris too. It's not going to kill your plant, you know, in 1 year.
But the rhizome might not be as big.
Right,
the flowers
healthy.
May not be as large.
Right.
Okay.
And so that's the concern. And the way thrips vector viruses, they do it by acquiring the virus from a plant that's already infected with the virus when they're young. And they basically ingest that. And then that virus actually replicates inside their gut. And then it comes and moves back up to their salivary glands. And so by the time they're a little bit older, then they've got the virus. And the virus is resident in them. So every time they feed on a different plant, they're injecting the virus into it. So that's called persistent propagative type of transmission, which is a tough one to battle. And also, when there's a plant that has the virus in it that they feed on, if they then lay their eggs on that plant, then the next round of offspring will acquire the virus and so on.
So do they have piercing, sucking mouth parts versus chewing mouth parts?
No, they don't exactly. What we call them are called punch and suck. And what they do is they just have one of their mandibles. So most insects have two mandibles. Those are the little chewing mouth parts. But in the case of thrips, they just have one of those, and it's modified into this kind of cone-shaped structure on the mouth that has a stylet that comes out and punches a hole into the tissue and then it laps up the sap or the
like
juice.
A mosquito?
Yeah, not quite, because a mosquito injects it more like as a proboscis and stays inside the plant while it's feeding, the mouth parts do, and suck out like a straw. Whereas this guy, it's punching a hole, or I should say girl, punching a hole and then sap, licking up lapping up that the juice that's released, basically. So we call that punch and suck.
And are thrips overwinterers, or do they blow up on the winds like the beet leafhopper?
They are overwinterers, and so they do that as adults. So there's not many out there in the winter in terms of when it's cold. You know, they're not active, and they just find places to kind of hunker down and go into a low metabolic state. But there's plenty of vegetation out there in the agricultural landscape. It's crops like alfalfa that overwinter that are a good host. Some of the winter wheat.
Yeah, I noticed
wheat.
This article, it was saying where these crops like alfalfa, corn, wheat, low, there weren't a lot of thrips, where with alfalfa it was medium, common mallow it was pretty high.
Right, and so a lot of weeds that they'll overwinter on as well. And so they can even carry adults can carry this virus in them throughout that winter too, and then have it, you know, the next spring and start feeding on more plants and spreading the virus that way as well too.
I'm imagining it's probably not too devastating for the home gardener, but when you've got a commercial enterprise and your onion fields are infected, that's affecting your bottom line.
It can really affect your bottom line.
So what do you do?
So insecticides have been the primary management tool because it's something that you can go and purchase, relatively easy to use. The downsides are that, well, number one, it doesn't kill them all, and so its effectiveness can be modest. It depends. You have to have a pretty heavy insecticide program to be really suppress the populations. But then you are prone to develop resistance in the thrips to the insecticides, so then after a while it doesn't work so well. So the other main things that we've been really exploring with this onion system is looking at ways we can try to make the crop less attractive to thrips. You're always going to have some out there, no doubt, but what you want to avoid are those really high populations, and then once they get the virus, that they're spreading it rapidly. So we do things like manage the fertility, and we found that where you have high levels of nitrogen applied, it actually makes the plants more attractive. They're darker green in color. They may be giving off different chemical volatiles. We've also speculated that it may be when there's lots of nitrogen in the tissue of the onion plant, it may also tone down some of these secondary compounds that actually are beneficial to the plant and fighting off, you know, making it less suitable for an insect to feed on. You can think about, like, you know, bitter taste, things like in potatoes, the glycosides. Those are things that, you know, many insects don't like to eat, including some people don't like to eat. And so those are the kinds of compounds that lots of nitrogen can kind of overwhelm and tone those down.
Can you use like spinosad or BT on thrips?
Spinosad is actually a pretty good product. BT not. It is a selective for certain types of insects, such as caterpillars, and so it's not effective on thrips. But spinosad is.
Okay, so if you've got thrips in your garden, what's the easiest way to take care of those? I've noticed, we've talked about this before, I see them on my dahlias, the lighter colored mm-hmm. dahlias they seem to go for.
So you want to have a good fertility program. I mean, in other words, you don't want to nitrogen starve your plants. So you ought to apply enough, but not too much. You don't want over fertilization. Also, plant diversity is helpful. So rather than having large plantings of one thing that then can be attractive to certain kinds of pests, thrips or other things, diversify. So break it up into smaller plantings of a little of this, a little of that. And even in the garden, you can do this by planting a few rows of something and then a few rows of something else. You know, you have to make it work within your productivity system, obviously, but more diversity, breaking it up, smaller clumps of different things, reduce the amount of pests, and not just thrips, but many insects that fly in looking for certain plants that they're attracted to. And then when it's more of an array of different things, they have a harder time, finding the ones they want, and you don't get as many.
Well, I wanted to turn our attention to talking about a new invasive species that hasn't quite made it to Utah, but it's on Utah's doorstep in Colorado now, and that's the emerald ash borer. And from what I've read on this insect, it's pretty devastating.
It's very scary, and it's bad in Boulder. I mean, by the time they actually realized it was there last summer at some point, it was already well established. And that's one of the real difficult things about this emerald ash borer is that we don't have a very effective trap for it. There are some traps. They're not that good. A lot of times the trees, when a tree gets infested, it's not obvious at first until you really start to see some of the decline going on, and by then it's heavily infested. So it's difficult to detect, and it spreads very rapidly. And so ash are the hosts, and many different kinds of ash. And yes, it's not going to fly across the Rocky Mountains by itself, but it's being moved by people. And so once you get vehicles, materials, RVs, things like that can transport insects around really easily, it's likely to show up here in the not-too-distant future, unfortunately.
Where did it come from?
So it's native to Asia, and it was brought into the U.S. I guess Michigan was the first place where it showed up around the Detroit area in 2002.
And it's already gotten this far.
Oh, yes. West. And wow. It's killed, millions and millions of ash trees now, from especially starting that north-central kind of foci and down into the Midwest. And now coming toward the west. So, yeah, I mean, it's scary. I drive through the little town of Smithfield here in Cache County on my way to and from work, and it's one of those typical Utah towns that are lined with ash, these huge, large ash trees. And that's another thing, is that this borer attacks fully, mature, established trees, not just like young trees. And so... that kind of scenario may no longer, be really sad to lose those kinds of trees.
So if it's not Dutch elm, it's yep. now the ash borer.
Yep.
And there's not really anything that can happen.
It's there. You can use some insecticides. The systemic types are not working well for this, but you can do preventive trunk sprays. But the problem is, oftentimes, by the time you realize that the insect is a problem in an area, there's a lot of infested trees. It's not a curative. It's not going to, take care of the insects that are already inside. So it's difficult to manage. Yeah.
What are the predators of this insect in Asia?
I'm not certain, but just in general, for flat-headed beetles, there are certainly some different kinds of parasitoids, little wasps that attack the larvae and the eggs. The adults are harder because they're a flattened, hardened, metallic beetle, and not too many insects or other things feed on those. Certainly birds to some extent would eat these, but it doesn't tend to be a major suppression effect.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Diane Alston, USU's Extension Entomologist, is in the studio with me, and we'd love to have your questions or comments. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment there, or send us an email at zestygarden@gmail.com. So as far as preparation for the growing season here, anything that we should be doing? I mean, there's snow on the ground, so not a whole lot. But I am going to be going out and doing some pruning.
Right. So this is a great time now to do your pruning of fruit trees and ornamental trees and shrubs that you need to clean up a bit. For fruit trees in particular, your goal is to open up the canopy a bit so we get some sun penetration down in there to the lower limbs. You don't want it to have too heavy of limbs, and you want limbs that are at good angles to support fruit, not ones that are shooting straight up, such as water sprouts and things. So this is a good time to do that. And then is to think ahead the next little bit when we get to the point where we start to have some bud swelling and getting close to some early spring activity. Think about your dormant sprays. These are always a very effective way to go for suffocating insects that overwinter on the limbs of fruit trees and ornamental trees and shrubs. And so it's a very inexpensive and easy treatment, because at that time you don't have all the leaves and things in the way to deal with. So getting yourself some Supreme type oil at your local gardening store called Dormant Oil, and applying that just as the buds are starting to show a little bit of color, you know, some green tissue or a little bit of flower color showing. But before that comes out, that's the ideal time to do that.
And that could be St. George area.
Right. I'm sure that they're probably there on the brink of it right now. So
I know our listener, it's in Beaver Dam, Arizona, would probably send, I remember him sending me a picture in February, that was a year or two ago. I'm like, this is no fair. These trees are breaking out already. So,
right.
So be on the lookout.
The almonds orchards are blooming in California right now.
Well, Diane, we've still got a few more minutes left with Petals and Pros, but this segment is done, and I appreciate you coming in.
Right. Thanks for thinking about early season insects and gardening.
And we've got in our gardening calendar, the Utah Botanical Center will host a plant propagation course beginning Thursday, February 20th from 7 to 9 at the USU Botanical Center greenhouse. The course is comprehensive, hands-on, five-class course. Details are at usubotanicalcenter.org. And USU Forestry Extension will hold a Learn at Lunch webinar on soil basics and how Utah is adapting Tuesday, February 25th from noon to 1 o'clock. For more information, go online to forestry.usu.edu.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Pros, and I want to continue talking about orchids, this unusual and most often beautiful flower. Orchids have diverse and unflower-like looks. One species looks just like a German shepherd dog with its tongue sticking out. One species looks like an onion. One looks like an octopus. One looks like a human nose. One looks like a kind of fancy shoes that a king might wear. One looks like Mickey Mouse. One looks like a monkey. One looks dead. One was described in 1845 Botanical Registry as looking like, quote, an old-fashioned headdress peeping over one of those starched high collars such as ladies wore in the days of Queen Elizabeth, or through a horse collar decorated with gaudy ribbons. So this is, again, Susan Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief. And she continues, there are species that look like butterflies, bats, ladies' handbags, bees, swarms of bees, female wasps, clamshells, roots, camel horses, hooves, squirrels, nuns dressed in their wimples, and drunken old men. The genus Dracula is a blackish red that looks like a vampire bat. There's another one that looks like a ghost, but has also been described as looking like a bandy-legged dancer, a white frog, and a fairy. Many wild orchids in Florida have common names based on their looks, such as twisted, shiny-leafed, cowhorn, lips, snake, leafless-beaked, rat-tail, mule ear, shadow witch or water spider, false water spider, ladies' tresses, and false ladies' tresses. In 1678, the botanist Jacob Brain wrote, "The manifold shape of these flowers arouses our highest admiration. They take on the forms of little birds, lizards, insects. They look like a man, like a woman, sometimes like an austere, sinister fighter, sometimes like a clown who excites our laughter. They represent the image of a lazy tortoise or a melancholy toad, an agile, ever-chattering monkey. Orchids have always been thought of as beautiful but strange." A wildflower guide published in 1917 called them queer freaks. The smallest orchids are microscopic, and the biggest ones have masses of flowers as large as footballs. Botanists have reported seeing a cowhorn orchid in Fetahatchee Swamp with normal-sized flowers and 34 pseudobulbs, which the bulging, tuber-shaped growths at the base of the plant where energy is stored. Each one is over 10 inches long. Some orchid flowers have petals as soft as powder, and other species have flowers rigid and rubbery as inner tubes. Raymond Chandler, the mystery writer who writes about Nero Wolfe, who owns thousands of orchids, wrote that orchids have the texture of human flesh. Orchids' colors are extravagant. They can be freckled or mottled or veiny or solid, from nearly neon to spotless white. Most species are more than one color. They'll have ivory petals and a hot pink lip, maybe, or green petals with burgundy stripes, or yellow petals with olive speckles, and a purple lip with a smear of red underneath. Some orchids have color combinations you wouldn't be caught dead wearing. Some look like the results of an accident involving paint. There are white orchids, but there is no such thing as a black orchid, even though people have been wanting a black orchid forever. It was black orchid extract that Basil St. John, the comic book character Brenda Starr, needed in order to control his rare, mysterious blood disease. I once asked Bob Fuchs, the owner of RF Orchids in Homestead, Florida, if he thought a black orchid would ever be discovered or be produced by hybridizing. No. Never in real life, he said, only in Brenda Starr. Many plants pollinate themselves, which guarantees that they will reproduce and keep their species alive. The disadvantage of self-pollination is it recycles some of the same genetic material over and over, so self-pollinating species endure but don't evolve or improve themselves. Self-pollinating plants remain simple, common weeds. The orchid family could have died out like dinosaurs if insects had chosen to feed on simpler plants and not orchids. The orchids wouldn't have been pollinated, and without pollination, they would never have grown seeds. While self-pollinating simple plants grown nearby would have seeded themselves constantly and spread like mad and taken up more and more space and light and water, and eventually orchids would have been pushed to the margins of evolution and disappeared. Instead, orchids have multiplied and diversified and have become the biggest flowering plant family on Earth because each orchid species has made itself irresistible. Many species look so much like their favorite insects that the insect mistakes them for kin, and when it lands on the flower to visit, pollen sticks to its body. In a book about orchids by an orchid collector, in Madagascar, there must be moths with proboscis capable of extension to a length of 10 or 12 inches. This belief of mine has been ridiculed by some entomologists, but we now know from Fritz Müller that there is a sphinx moth in South Brazil which has a proboscis of nearly sufficient length. For when dried out, it was between 10 and 11 inches long. When not protruded, the proboscis is coiled up in a spiral of at least 20 windings. Some huge moth with a wonderfully long proboscis could drain the last drop of nectar. If such great moths become extinct in Madagascar, surely certain orchids would become extinct as well. Darwin was very interested in how orchids released pollen. He experimented by poking them with needles, camel hair brushes, bristles, pencils, and his fingers. He discovered that parts were so sensitive that they released pollen upon the slightest touch, but that moderate degrees of violence on the less sensitive parts had no effect, which he concluded meant that the orchid wouldn't release pollen haphazardly. It was smart enough to save it for only the most favorable encounters with bugs. He wrote, "Orchids appeared to have been modeled in the wildest caprice, but this, no doubt, is due to our ignorance of their requirements and conditions of life. Why do orchids have so many perfect contrivances for their fertilization? I am sure that many other plants offer analogous adaptations of high perfection, but it seems they are really more numerous and perfect with Orchidaceae than most other plants. Some species of orchids grow in the ground, others don't live in soil at all. The ones that don't grow in soil are called epiphytes, and they live their lives attached to tree branch or a rock. Epiphytic orchids' seeds settle in a comfortable spot, sprout, grow, dangle their roots in the air, and live a lazy life absorbing rainwater and decayed leaves and light. They aren't parasites. They give nothing to the tree and get nothing from it except a good place to sit. Most epiphytes evolved in tropical jungles where so many living things compete for the jungle floor that most species lose the fight and die out. Being an orchid hunter has always meant pursuing beautiful things in terrible places. From the mid-1800s to the early 1900s, when orchid hunting was at its prime, terrible places were really terrible places, and any man advertising himself as a hunter needed to be hardy, sharp, and willing to die from home. No one in England is very good at cultivating or breeding tropical orchids at the time, so hunters were on the way to get nursery stock, let alone new species. The large nurseries implied crews of hunters. In 1894, for instance, the preeminent Victorian orchid grower Frederick Saunder had 60 greenhouses at his estate in St. Albans, employed 23 hunters, collecting around the world for him, including a man in Mexico, two in Brazil, two in Colombia, two in Peru, one in Madagascar, one in New Guinea, three in India, one in the Strait Settlement. One of Saunder's best hunters was Benedict Rotzel, a tough-looking Czech. Rotzel had cut off his left hand accidentally while in Havana demonstrating a machine that he invented for extracting fiber from hemp. The iron hook he used took its place, added to his grim appearance. Rotzel combed across South America and discovered 800 new orchid species in his travel. At its peak of Victorian orchid fever, there were scores of orchid hunters crisscrossing the world for different growers. In 1993, three poachers were arrested in the Everglades with a haul of alpine silk butterflies, a species that had sold for $37,000 in Japan. In Fakahatchee Swamp, rangers are kept busy arresting hunters for hunting deer illegally at night for using a stunning floodlight. Alligators vanish all the time. Recently, two men were arrested in the Loxahatchee for killing an alligator. They'd shot it dead, cut off a 29-inch piece of its tail, loaded it into a canoe, then somehow capsized their canoe and got into a fight over which of them had caused the canoe to tip over. When the rangers arrested them, they were still in the middle of the fight. Many people in the orchid world knew about certain successes with the ghost orchids, but people got calls all the time from those who wanted to buy one. That week, the woman working with the ghost orchid had already gotten a call from Tampa, a call from California. The woman in California told Savalia that she was desperate for a ghost orchid and how much Savalia wanted one of hers. "I told her $100, Savalia said honestly. "I could have given $1,000. "It's not really about collecting the thing itself," LaRoche once told me. "It's about getting immersed in something and learning about it and having it become part of your life. It's a kind of direction." He stopped on the word direction and chortled. "If anyone had a plant I don't have, I made sure to get it. It was like a heroin addiction. If I ever had money, I would spend it on plants. When my wife and I had our nursery, we had 40,000, just totally unimaginable plants. "What was your favorite?" Susan Orlean asked him. He scuffled his heel in the dirt. "I think it would have to be a little gorgeous ginger plant a friend got me in New Zealand. It had first been collected 100 years ago, and I think I had the only one in cultivation. It had tiny round leaves, sort of brownish, with silver chevron markings, and I swear it looked like it was made out of crystal." Then all of the sorriness hardened into something less stifling, and I suddenly decided I would rather walk, no matter which way we went, than to sit here, idle and frantic, spinning my mind like a tire in the sand. I knew LaRoche wanted me to see a ghost orchid as much or even more than I wanted to see it myself, but now I really, most of all, wanted to go home. At this point, I realized it was just as well that I never see a ghost orchid, so that it could never disappoint me. It would remain forever something I wanted to see. And then in an interview that Susan Orlean gave People, an interview of her, she says, "There was a great piece years ago written by Janet Malcolm that argued there is a mutually exploitative relationship between a reporter and a subject. I have to agree with her. That does not mean that it's evil and corrupt. It just means that to not acknowledge that you are using each other for a reason, in other words, the reporter and the person being interviewed, and that it's this context of relationship is not a natural relationship. It's a very unnatural relationship. You're not having a friendship with John LaRoche. You're having a relationship with the context of a reporter. I don't think it means that it's false. It means that you always are aware that it's an unusual circumstance." Then the questioner asked her, "Have you ever been smitten by a subject?" And Susan Orlean answered, "Yes. He was a show dog. I fell in love with him, but he was a tough subject to interview." This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.